All right, welcome on to a Sunday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. It's been a couple of days. Most of the teams are pretty much have at least three games in the books. I think everyone does except for Memphis. So what Danny and I are going to do a little bit today is give you a little observation on all 30 teams. We'll call it 30 in 60 to try and get it done in an hour. We'll see whether we actually adhere to that timeline or not, and also do a little bit of news as well. Danny, what's up?
It doesn't feel like we're a week in, but at the same point, I've watched a lot of basketball, so it's been a lot of fun, though. I think that I feel much more comfortable with a couple teams now than I did before the season.
Who?
Orlando, Sacramento, well, except for the DeMarcus Cousins injury, but I couldn't figure out. I have a better sense of how good they are right now.
Okay. So we can talk about that when we get to them.
Mm-hmm.
They are O, so we'll be a little bit before we get to them. Start with the news, though. Mark Stein reporting just before we came on the air, Jeremy Lamb closing in on a 3-year, $21 million extension with the Hornets. Your thoughts?
I understand the rationale. They're trying to secure a player that they think has upside, but I think this is exactly why you have match rights, because there is a chance that he is worth this contract. There is a chance that he is not worth it, and I think that's why you wait out the year, because realistically, I mean, the odds that he got would get, let's say, like 440 or something like that seem really low right now. However, as is always the case when we talk about these contracts this early, we have to see what the last year is, because if that last year is a team option or non-guaranteed, that completely changes the way I think about this deal.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Although the Hornets really, their cap space may be worth less than perhaps nearly any team in the league right now. And he is a young player who has some modicum of upside. And, you know, this is going to be 7% of the cap. This is going to be eighth, ninth man money, essentially, once this cap rise is all said and done. And I think he certainly projects out to that. He actually looked pretty good today in that game against the Hawks, I thought. But offensively, his bigger problem is kind of just that he spaces out so much away from the ball. And he didn't, as you noted on Twitter, he didn't start or finish the game. But I think it's a decent risk for a team that is probably not going to do better than this money in free agency. So why not luck them up and see, you know, if you can find a good option for low costs over the next 4 years, essentially, with this being the last year of his rookie contract, for a guy who could maybe start for you, still has a lot of potential, still a young guy.
Sure. Yeah. That's totally fair too. That's kind of, I think we're about at the same mind of it. It's just, we're seeing different angles on the same story.
Yeah, it's just the opportunity cost here is lower than it is with quite a lot
the
of
the Lakers or the Wizards or somebody.
Exactly. The Pistons announced that Jody Meeks underwent surgery to repair a non-displaced fracture in his right foot. That was a fifth metatarsal fracture, I believe a Jones fracture.
Yes.
He is expected to be out 12 to 16 weeks. And this is a little bit troublesome for a Detroit team that's looked really good, especially defensively, to start off. Because now you're going to have three guys in the rotation who I really worry about. In Steve Blake, who has been horrendous offensively so far this year. Aaron Baines, who I feel the same way about and I don't think is a quality defensive player either. And then now you're relying on Reggie Bullock to step up, essentially. And while he was drafted in the 20s and seems to have some surface talent as a 3-and-D guy, he also was completely given up on by two organizations that could have desperately used that sort of a talent on the wing. So I think the odds are, until proven otherwise, we have to assume that he's not going to be that good. And so that Detroit starting lineup has been pretty good. And then they have Stanley Johnson as well, who's been solid, Anthony Tolliver as well. But then, you know, Tolliver can't play guard and he can't play center. So they need guys who are going to fulfill those roles.
And as you kind of alluded to with the issues with the bench, that also puts them in very precarious spot in terms of any further injuries. Like, this is a team that is really close to having something a lot more serious, because their starting five has been strong. But if they, you know, if they're starting to get to that area where if anything happens, then it starts to bleed into the main guys.
Also worth noting that Arne Kander is gone this year. It'll be, you know, interesting to see what happens with their injuries. Not that that can be unilaterally ascribed to the fact that their trainer
did he go to Minnesota
left, but yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
One's kind of a sad note. Nate Robinson, after signing with the Pelicans about a week before the season started, was waived Ish Smith signed with them like a day before the season started and immediately took his rotation spot. And I fear that this may be it for Nate Robinson, unfortunately, in the NBA. And he's a guy whose career at least deserves a little bit of mention if this is indeed going to be it for him.
Yeah, he's really carved out a spot in the league, and it's a little bit unfortunate that he has so much of a reputation as kind of the ancillary stuff, like his summer league performances and the dunk contest, because he was actually a very solid contributor to NBA teams.
Yeah, it was too bad that he could never quite break through to really being a starter, but he just had a few too many limitations defensively. He was never quite what his physical gifts might have indicated he could be defensively, and was never quite enough of a distributor to really be a starting point guard, but we'll still definitely have some of his great moments, like that Game 4 in 2013 first round against the Nets, where he basically won the Bulls that series.
Yeah, do you want to move on to DeMarcus Cousins?
Yeah, strained right Achilles. He is day-to-day, so he had to leave the second half of their loss to the Clippers last night. So we'll see how long it takes for him to get back, but obviously the Achilles, not something you want to mess around with.
Yeah, you really don't want to push it. I was impressed that the Clippers came back in that game. They didn't end up winning it, but I thought once they went down without him that they were dead in the water, and they had a nice little run back. They ended up losing, but I was impressed with that all the same.
Mark Stein also reported that there, in fact, have been talks between the Warriors and Festus Ezeli through having some discussions myself. That is the case. It wasn't true that there were literally no discussions. I think it'd be fair to characterize that it wasn't advanced. But, you know, I still don't think that one is going to get done necessarily. And Ezeli has been kind of about what you'd expect from him through these first three games of the season.
Yeah. I don't think I have anything more. I've always said when teams agree, except for maybe Drummond, because that's a little bit different, when teams agree to table it, we can wait until after tomorrow to really see, because you never know when things can reopen.
Yeah, and the last observation I've had just in a general sense so far, and some people have tweeted about this as well, the new emphasis on playing faster has definitely had an effect. I think teams are playing at about three possessions per 100 faster overall in the aggregate, but they're also 3 points per 100 worse from an efficiency standpoint so far as the same point last year. I wouldn't necessarily make a ton of that yet. I mean, that is more descriptive than predictive, but still worth noting so far that teams are playing faster, and the offense has nonetheless been worse so far.
Yeah, it definitely has been, and I don't have too much to say to that, except that while we're talking about fast-paced games, we might as well get some words from our sponsor.
Actually, you're so much better at the segues than I am. So that sponsor, of course, is DraftKings.com. Basketball is back, and you can be part of the action all season long at DraftKings.com, the destination for daily fantasy basketball. Everyone knows that season-long fantasy basketball is pretty inscrutable. You've got all these categories you have to worry about. How many games per week your players are playing. On DraftKings, much easier, right? You don't have to watch all the games every night. You can just pick a night, pick your best lineup, pick the guys that you have the best value for, really study up on the matchups that one night, and you can get some entertainment about it, and then not have to worry about it every single day like you do with season-long fantasy basketball. So it's a lot of fun. Brand new season every day at DraftKings. You can play whenever you want, and you can win serious cash or unserious cash, whatever your preference is, that night. DraftKings even offers some games that are 100% free to play. You've got nothing to lose. You could challenge your friends and coworkers in a custom league, or you can create new rivalries with fantasy players from all over the country and turn your love of basketball into a payday. Use the promo code CAPSPACE, all one word, and you can remember that because we talk about CAPSPACE all the time on this show, at DraftKings.com right now, and you can play for free with your first deposit. The promo code is CAPSPACE, and you can get free entry now at DraftKings.com.
Do you want to hear my do you want to hear my segue for this one?
That wasn't a very good segue, but yeah, sure.
Speaking of CAPSPACE, this is a team that wished they had a little bit more of it this summer, the first team in our 30 and 60, the Atlanta Hawks.
Yeah, although it's interesting to know, I don't know whether they actually would have wanted to re-sign Carroll for the amount that he got. They might have felt like that was too much for him, especially to have him making more than some of their stalwart players, like a guy like Al Horford, who you know, is obviously a better player than Carroll. But in any event, basically we'll try and go through each, give like a minute-long observation or so on these teams. The Hawks have righted the ship after a first-night loss that was pretty ugly to the Pistons, but the Pistons look pretty good so far, so that doesn't look too bad. And they've beaten the Hornets twice. And they have beaten, who else am I forgetting here?
The Knicks.
And the Knicks on that Thursday night. We talked about on the last show, Kent Bazemore didn't look too good. Since then, he's had back-to-back 19-point games against the Hornets. And he's really seems to have improved his jump shot a little bit. His right hand looks good as well. And that's something, especially for a guy who has a lot of length and kind of can slither to the rim, it's really helpful to be ambidextrous for a guy who's a lefty and can go right pretty well. So, maybe there's a little bit more hope for Kent Bazemore. Two good games, do not a career make, but he's on the right track.
Yeah, on the right track is a good word for it. And what I'm interested there that we haven't seen is Tim Hardaway Jr. I mean, there you can think about what they gave up in terms of draft assets, but also just that I'm interested because they certainly saw something in him to make the decision they made, and we haven't seen him at all.
He's been a healthy scratch all of these games, as far as I can tell. I asked people on Twitter today if they had heard anything about an injury. I haven't seen anything, so it looks like he has just been out of the rotation, and Lamar Patterson is in the rotation.
Their coach is just biting their GM.
Well, that's right, because everyone joked that the reason they signed Hardaway was because he had that huge game for the Knicks at the end of the year, the one of the games that knocked the Knicks out of the number one seed in the lottery against the Hawks, and again, the Hawks probably weren't trying too hard because they had long wrapped up the number one seed. Maybe as it turned out, Coach Bo was less impressed with him in training camp.
So the Celtics, I think we're both going to say about the same thing, but it's that they have a lot of guys, but I don't think they're playing them in the right combinations and at the right times. And for me, this a great crystallization of this was at the end of the game against the Spurs tonight. They put Sullinger in and on LaMarcus Aldridge for a series of possessions, but on three consecutive possessions, they basically just ISO'd, posted up LaMarcus, and LaMarcus just took him to school, three baskets, and that functionally ended the game.
Yeah, that's right. And you're no better off having Jared Sullinger guarding LaMarcus Aldridge in a pick-and-pop either, if you're the Celtics. And it was weird. They had Amir Johnson on the floor with him. I would have gone with Kelly Olynyk. I still think that Olynyk and Johnson is their best lineup. They also went with the three guards on the stretch, and they had Smart guarding Kawhi Leonard, and he actually did an okay job on Kawhi when Kawhi tried to post him up a couple of times, other than just leaving him in the corner for no reason one time. But in the one-on-one matchup, he was okay. So I wouldn't even mind seeing them go with the three guards and then Jay Crowder at the four and Amir Johnson at the five, or even maybe some Jarebko as well. You could do a lot more switching that way, really spread things out. But another thing to note in the front court rotation today, Zeller and Lee both started. Zeller played 6 minutes. I believe he did not play at all in the second half. Lee was 1 out of 7 with 2 turnovers, although he did have 8 rebounds in 20 minutes. And Lee has not finished either of the last 2 games, I believe. So, you know, maybe starting him is going to be the kind of way to keep him quiet. But, you know, if he keeps playing like this, which I frankly quite expect him to, given his age and current body composition, I think it would make sense to just get him out of the rotation. And another thing too, Olynyk hasn't been able to hit a shot, but are you now going to not play him because he's missed, you know, like a few three-pointers in 3 games, or do you believe in him actually being a good shooter? I still think that he is probably should be the guy who's out there at the four, and I think he's a little bit of an underrated defender.
Yeah, I just hope we see some Crowder at the four, because I think that's the best position for him, and they should be looking at improving everywhere, so you might as well see what you have in him at the four, considering you just signed him to that long contract.
Yeah, and maybe Stevens will work it out and get him to where they need to be, and they're 1-2 right now, so you know they can't afford to mess around too much. But they got to figure out which of the guys are good. I mean, they've also been playing Jarebko at the three, which is no good. He like got roasted a couple of times in this game trying to play the three. He's not a good defender at the three. He's another guy who's better at the four. So, I mean, we've stated many times our opinion of who their best guys are, but they have a lot of these other names who they feel like they need to play a little bit. You know, you could count Evan Turner in that category too. So we'll see if Stevens can figure it out. The Nets are fulfilling everyone's worst expectations for being the most boring team in the league. One thing that is particularly worrisome for them they are averaging a mere 12.7 three-point attempts per game, and they are making less than three of them, so they are shooting a terrible percentage, and they are not getting any threes. And this team, though, Danny, like, they don't have, like, that bad a shooting if you just look at the names, right?
No, I agree with you. I think that they, I mean, you don't know if Thaddeus Young is really going to take threes, but the rest of the guys are at least fine on that end. They aren't egregiously bad.
Yeah, and even someone like Bargnani could take a few threes.
He's over the one he airballed.
Bojan Bogdanovic is a decent shooter. Joe Johnson, obviously, a good shooter. I mean, Jarrett Jack is not going to take threes, really. Larkin is, like, not horrible as a three-point shooter. But the bigger problem, I think, is the philosophy a little bit. You know, Hollins has never been a guy to emphasize playing that way too much. But more importantly, they just don't have anyone who can achieve dribble penetration. And when you can't get to the basket, you can't force help, and you can't get guys open for those threes, no matter how good of shooters you have, unless maybe you have just incredible ball movement like the Hawks do, and that obviously is not the Nets.
Yeah, that isn't the Nets. I was just going to say ball movement, because that has been another weakness for them, not only this year, but I would say fair portions of last year too, though they had some nice stretches.
Yeah, I mean, if they're playing Jarrett Jack and Joe Johnson big minutes, like, those guys are not exactly like ball movers. So the Hornets, did you watch that game today against the Hawks?
I did. There were moments of it that I was actually really impressed with them. I still don't see how they're going to defend. You know, it's one of those Steve Clifford trust things where I just think that they'll have a good defense. But I was impressed with that they got back in the game against the Hawks. It was another one of those. I talked about this with the Kings in the news section, where once they kind of started trailing, I think they were down 10 or so, in the third quarter, I just went, okay, you know, it's going to be one of those games the Hawks cruise and win by 10 to 15, and then they came all the way back and made it close.
Spencer Hawes is rapidly becoming perhaps my least favorite player to watch in the entire league. And just aesthetically, even when he shoots his three-pointer, he looks like he's about to, like, totter over at any time. Like, he looks like every moment, every movement that he has is just like one of his limbs could just like break off or he could keel over. So there's that aspect of it. Also, his game, like, he keeps trying to be some sort of like mini David Lee, like floater, facilitate, attack from the 3-point line type of player. And he's just not that. Every time he tries to post up or dribble or spin, he holds the ball. He doesn't make a quick decision. He'll try to drive in from the three-point line and shoot this floater that just never goes in. It's really just totally miserable to watch him. I still think he has some talent if he just stuck to only shooting open threes, going for offensive rebounds, and then just trying to play defense. I think he could be an okay backup center. But at this point, why not just put Kaminsky in at the backup center? That's what I think Kaminsky ultimately is going to be great at. Kaminsky is actually good at shooting three-pointers, where Hawes is pretty average. Kaminsky is actually good at getting to the basket off the dribble and making a play for himself or others, which Hawes is not. You know, I don't think he's going to really be that much worse than Hawes is defensively, but the Hornets have Kaminsky pigeonholed in as a four, and now he's competing with Zeller and Marvin Williams, who actually had a nice game today.
He did.
For minutes at the four. So, I mean, just get rid of Hawes. He's not part of the future. Kaminsky is. I think Kaminsky is probably better than Hawes right now, frankly.
And you can even not even get rid of him, because I don't think they can, but just move him out of the rotation or move him into a smaller role, because...
Yeah, he was the price for getting rid of Stevenson. He's not supposed to be playing 25 minutes a game.
Yeah, and what's so frustrating about it is they have other options. This isn't a situation... I'm not saying they're world beaters. It's not one of those situations like what we complained about Mirotic last year or somebody like that, but they're in a situation where I don't think that, as you said, the downside risk is that high, and... there is still plenty of time, like the Celtics, there's plenty of time for it to resolve, but at this point it seems pretty clear what Hawes' limitations are.
All right, the Chicago Bulls. Fred Hoiberg has made some nice adjustments so far. I've liked a lot of the things that he is doing as a coach. Not playing Noah and Gasol together, obviously, was something which really needed to happen, and he's not doing that. Noah acknowledged in a quote that he thinks he's better as a five and understands at least why Hoiberg is bringing him off the bench, although there was this Hoiberg said to Zach Lowe that Noah came to him and Noah said, no, I didn't ask to come off the bench, you know, but that's all semantics. But Hoiberg turns into Coach Hoibergo which Simpsons fans will remember Mr. Burns had to use Senor Spielbergo as the director of his film when Steven Spielberg was unavailable. And so he's been using what I've been calling the Hoibergo lineup, and that is a lineup without Gasol, Mirotic, Butler, or Rose for enormous stretches of the game. Those are their four best offensive players. There's no reason why you should have all of those guys off the floor at one time, ever. And shockingly, that lineup has played 30 minutes together so far in three games. It is the second most used lineup behind the starters, and no other lineup has more than 6 minutes together. So Hoiberg is playing a lineup without any of their four best offensive players, the second most of any lineup. And that unit is getting killed by 17 points per 100 possessions. They can't score at all. Big shock, because they don't have anyone who's any good. And it just, at least offensively. And then it just devolves into Aaron Brooks trying to create one-on-one every time. And guess what? He's not good enough to do that.
Feedback loops.
Nikola Mirotic is having an awesome season.
Absolutely fantastic. And, I mean, he was... I still think about that moment in the Cavs game, the first game of the year, when he just did a pull-up three. But he's playing with so much confidence. And I love him playing with Rose. I really like that combination. I love the space that it creates. And Rose, you know, he's been a little bit up and down, but I think that's helped a lot.
Yeah, Rose is saying, oh, I'm going into facilitator mode. And for people who don't know, Rose actually did play that way when he was at Simeon in high school. He was well known as a guy who was supposed to be a great pure point guard. And we kind of lost that at Memphis, really lost it for the Bulls. Rose has always maintained, that's what I want to do. Instead of being a scorer, the league like forced me to be a scorer, was his quote after the game. I don't know whether I believe that, because I'm not sure how great of a facilitator he actually really is. And he's also not getting to the foul line at all. That really has not helped. He's at least stopped taking three-pointers so much, which is good. And the Bulls have been getting some good balance outside of course, that terrible isolation jump shot he took when they could have won the game at Detroit on Friday. Big surprise, Rose took a step back, pull-up going to his left with the game on the line.
Yeah. So Cleveland, I think the big thing for me is I have no idea how and why they're defending as well as they are.
Yeah, they are at 90 points per 100 possessions on D through three games. They just completely locked down Memphis. The Heat, who have looked relatively good aside from that one game against Cleveland, and the Bulls also, they held below a point per possession. Love looks really good offensively, but I mean, just look at the individual defenders they have on this team. I mean, Mozgov hasn't been playing that much. Love has never really been that great in his career, if perhaps a little bit too harshly maligned, given what they're able to do on some of those teams in Minnesota. Shumpert is out, so you got like J.R. Smith and Mo Williams
Richard Jefferson's playing minutes on this team.
Yeah, Jefferson will at least, he's a vet, he'll execute the system, but he's not going to lock anyone down one-on-one. I think Delly has been good, as he always is, defensively. Yeah, another note, too, in that game against the Heat, I think Delly had 9 assists and only 1 2-point field goal attempt. That is just terrible scouting report defense by the Heat, because if you're giving up, you're allowing him to get penetration to where he can get 9 assists, and he had a ton of those alley-oop assists that he loves. Make him shoot a two-pointer. Don't back off and let him throw it to the big on the roll. Especially if it's alley-oop to Tristan Thompson, make the guy score himself on a two-point bucket. He's not going to be able to do it.
Incidentally, the Heat were actually getting a few of those looks themselves today, where they were just seeding the alley-oop to Hassan Whiteside. So it's kind of funny that happened, I think, in consecutive games where they kind of the same mistake happened on both ends.
So the Dallas Mavericks, they had one game that we talked about on Thursday's program where they didn't bring their whole team and they got predictably blown out. Wes Matthews didn't play. He looks pretty darn good, though, so far, doesn't he? I mean, I haven't seen any of this Lakers game that's going on concurrent with us recording, but seeing some positive reports there. Parsons is back. Williams is back. Deron Williams is back also today. So it seems like the health picture for those guys is about as good as we reasonably could have hoped going into the season. And if those guys really can play and get back, I think this team could actually challenge for the playoffs still, shockingly enough.
Yeah, they need everyone healthy, but if they have everyone healthy, they're pretty good. I mean, Dirk's not going to go 10-13 and have 25 points on 13 shots like he has so far tonight. But when you get that, and I mean, I'm really impressed always with Rick Carlisle, but I'm really pleasantly surprised by how they've been so far.
The Denver Nuggets shooting is going to be a real problem for this team. They don't really have anyone that you can look at as an established three-point shooter. Maybe you could say Gallo, but you want him to have the ball in his hands a lot, and he's always sort of been a little bit overrated as a just stand-still, space-the-floor three-point shooter. Moutier can shoot threes okay off the dribble, but is not a spacer. And the Nuggets have struggled to score really badly since that opening night victory in Houston. We all thought that they would probably regress, but surprisingly enough, only one of those results has turned around so far.
Yeah, and with Denver, I think that the other part of it, and this is something you and I talk about a lot, is that not only do they have a lack of shooters, but they have a lack of shooters that teams respect. And that can, those sometimes are the same thing, sometimes they're different, and that allows teams to defend Denver in a way that clogs the lane a little bit more than they would hope. But, you know, I think that in some ways it's a good thing for Denver eventually, just because I think they need one more year to struggle, but they need to know what they have in all their pieces.
Yeah, and Jim Peterson noted on the broadcast on Friday night when the Wolves beat them, Jim is the great color guy for the Timberwolves, probably the best local color guy in the league. He noted that the scouting report for Mitchell was there telling everyone to go under on Moutier, and he hit a couple of shots, but I think that's still going to be the scouting report for a while. He's got a ways to go before he's going to be able to counterman that.
Yeah. So now we move on to maybe arguably the season's biggest success story so far, the Detroit Pistons.
2-1, and is that right? Are they 2-0? No, they're 3-0. Right?
They ended up winning that game.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, so they've beaten the Bulls and the Jazz in two close ones at home, waxed the Hawks on the road. The defense has been really good. Andre Drummond has been unstoppable on the offensive glass. They're giving up 92 points per 100, which is fantastic so far. The offense has still been, you know, a little bit below average, which you might expect given the talent on the team. And Marcus Morris has been able to give them just enough kind of one-on-one offense to pair with Reggie Jackson and Drummond. And I think this team is going to be a problem all year. Drummond has looked so good defensively compared to where he was in the last couple of years.
And I think that was always the key with this team. We liked a lot of the moves that they made, but they were asking a lot of him, but so far he's delivered. So I think that, and I'm concerned about their increasing depth issues, but they're as long as they can keep that five together, KCP has still continued to play well.
Yeah, another interesting thing to look at, too, is who's going to close games for this team at the four. Stan obviously doesn't trust Stanley Johnson, a rookie, yet in that situation. Ilyasova has not been closing the games, and Anthony Tolliver has these last two close games that they've been in at the four. He's a better defensive option. He is someone who has improved his three-point shot, you know, since back in the days when he was getting dunked on by Amari Stoudemire in Golden State. But, you know, he also is still very switchable, and I think is overall an offensive liability other than just his ability to shoot, because he's not going to post you up if you switch. The Bulls switched a lot on the Pistons and did a pretty good job shutting them down in the overtime. That was a really low-scoring game, but the Pistons were ultimately able to close it out. So it'll be interesting to see who's going to kind of be that fifth guy down the stretch for the Pistons.
Yeah, that's a huge question. The Warriors came out of the gates incredibly strong. I think you and I could probably talk about what Stephen Curry has already done for a while, but he has been absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, all signs point to the preseason and what we've seen in these first three games that he is not only a little bit better than last year, but a lot better. You know, Draymond Green has been talking about how much higher his confidence is, how much better he is at getting to the basket. And my observation on Steph, and I'm sure we'll have more on him since that's our hometown team, but to me, he might be the most mentally challenging player to guard in NBA history. And the reason I say that is because pretty much anyone else that you're ever going to guard, you get some time off. You can relax mentally. But with Steph, he has the ball in his hand, so, and I'm talking about all five guys on the floor, even. Because if Steph has the ball, if your man goes to set a screen for him, you have to know the drill. And the drill is you either need to switch or you need to blitz Steph, because if he gets a three off, you are dead. I mean, Steph, there's no such thing as a bad three for him. You have to be so close to him that he just can't even get the shot off at all. And so that requires not only incredible concentration, but concentration in a way that is different than the scouting report from nearly any other player that you've ever faced in your basketball career. It's just really, really hard. You got to be on it all the time. You can't let up. And then even if you do execute properly, he still is good enough to beat you one-on-one anyway. So any screw-up, he punishes mercilessly, worse than anybody else in the NBA, basically, because it's a three. And you also, just even if you execute properly, he can just go by you, or he can hit a shot right in your eye, even if you play it perfectly.
And that was something in the 28-point quarter against New Orleans, the third quarter in the game on Saturday, is a lot of those possessions he was well-defended. Not all of them, but a lot of them he was well-defended, and he was just...
Yeah, well-defended for any other player.
Yeah.
Anthony Davis, for example, had a couple of times, like, Steph struggled against him a little bit on switches last year in the playoffs. Not so this time. And Davis doesn't look nearly as locked in as he did in the playoffs last year,
correct,
by the way. But you know, Davis was just, step late, but still got what would be considered a good challenge on virtually any other player in the NBA. And too late, you know, but it's an error. You could see it being an error, but it's just not an error against anyone else.
Does he look more confident in the lane to you? Because that's something else I've noticed this year, is it feels like he's more comfortable there than he was last year.
That's true. Yeah, he's got a little bit more spin. He's been able to get to the bucket, and he's also just being able to get more open layups than he ever did either, because he just has the ability, more moves now. He can blow by guys who are overplaying the jump shot as you have to. And I would actually say that Steph, and you noted in our outline that this is grammatically incorrect, but he is the most unique player in NBA history. And the reason I say that is because no one else in NBA history has ever been able to do what he's done. Now, you could say LeBron James, yeah, no one else has been able to make these type of plays at his size, but there still are people who have made those same types of plays. The type of plays that he makes, shooting from so far out and having it be a good shot off the dribble, the way that you have to defend him, is just totally different than anyone else ever in NBA history.
And also, he's doing it at a time when that is encouraged and cultivated. You could, like, the players that you draw is the most parallel to Stephen Curry, depending on which element of his game you want to model that after. None of them played in this period where you kind of get that green light. And also, what Curry deserves so much credit for is that he's done an amazing job, fueled partially by the Spurs series and the Clippers series, the two big playoff losses they had, to be able to handle double teams more. So you can't defend him in the ways that you used to be able to. So now, when you double him and when you do those things, then they can exploit that as a team, or he can individually. So then if you get, let's say, okay, I'll defend him one-on-one, then he just smokes you.
From last year's MVP, who looks awesome, to last year's MVP runner-up, who thought he should have been the MVP last year, who looks awful, James Harden.
He looked miserable today, and that was not an aberration.
No, yeah, all three of these games, he's been really bad. He was 0 out of 10 on threes today, and not being able to hit threes is a big problem for him, both in terms of their spacing, if they're going to try and run more through Lawson, which they really have not done effectively so far. And with Harden, he also just hasn't been able to get to the basket as well, the free throw line. He looks slower than he did. That could be the after effects, that knee contusion he suffered in the preseason. I noted that I was a little worried before the year, especially I talked about this on the Rockets podcast with Rahat Hook, about, you know, feeling like he doesn't keep himself in the most amazing shape from a body composition standpoint. And, you know, he definitely just doesn't look as good so far. I expect him. He's not going to keep being this bad.
Yeah.
You know, but it just, if your Bayesian prior was that he was going to take a little bit of a regression for those reasons, and now he starts off like this, you certainly have more reason to believe that now.
And Dwight Howard has only played 21 minutes, so that is something to kind of take some heart in if you're a Rockets fan. But there is this issue of regression with them. And also, I think Capella's looked good, which is nice. But, and Harold...
Yeah, all right, let me stop you on this thing, right? Because this is the thing about a lot of these Rockets guys, right? Monte Ellis, Terrence Jones, Capella. Now, Montrezl Harrell is another one of these guys. You know, these guys, I think that we tend to fall a little bit too much in love with them because they are kind of Morey Ball finds for where they were at their draft position, and I can't believe they're playing this big of a role so early. they're being pretty efficient from a box score standpoint. We never would have thought this they would have been this. Morey is so smart. I can't believe these guys are making so little money. And that's all true. The front office is to be commended for finding these guys, but might want to be a little bit more relaxed in concluding that these guys are really ready to play above average winning basketball in sort of the smarts, non-box score aspects of the game. And I'm not willing to foreclose on that, especially with Capella. We haven't seen him enough to really say that. But these are young guys, and the idea that you can count on them to be real contributors, starter-level guys on a playoff team, not proven yet.
And they're all playing intense support level roles. They aren't getting any responsibility. So that is something different. And as you're kind of alluding to in the playoffs, you have to expect more from those guys because other teams are going to focus more on taking away what you do well. And that was one of the things that hurt the Rockets against the Warriors in the playoffs.
The Pacers, another rough start. They are 0-3. The new offense has not looked good. They started Paul George at the four, two of the games. One of the games they went with traditional bigs to match up with Memphis. It is worth noting that they have played three very good defenses. The Raptors look much improved this year. And obviously Memphis and Utah are fantastic defensive teams. So maybe things will turn around for them. But still to monitor, we talked about this a little bit on Thursday. Monte Ellis does not look good. 4.4 PER in three games. His true shooting percentage is in the 30s. I do continue to wonder that they may have some issues with Ellis, and ultimately he might even be better off the bench, because I think at this point, if he's going to keep playing like this, he's taking the ball out of the hands of superior options like Hill and Paul George, neither of whom has been amazing so far, but have still been better than him. And, on the other hand, they signed him to starter money. He's under contract for $11 million a year for four more years, and he's already 30, so they got to get him turned around.
Yeah, they're in a tough spot. I think that their issue is that they just don't have enough talent. Like, I think that we talked about...
That's always a problem.
It is, and I think that they're kind of one guy away. Like, if you could slide everyone down, let's say they had somebody, a starting caliber shooting guard, just to slide everyone down the rotation, I think it would fix a lot of things, but they just don't. They don't have that guy. And with what makes them distinct among that group is, really at any position, if they could get one guy who was their third best player, at any position, I think they can make it work.
Yeah, that might be true. And whether that's going with more traditional bigs or whatever, I mean, they are going to have $30 million in cap space this summer, not traditionally a free agent destination. But if they can have an okay year this year, and I think they'll turn it around a little bit, although that sure was a sparse crowd in Indy on Saturday in that game.
And Turner will be better, too, like in a little bit of time.
Yeah, I think so. He looks very mobile. He's actually hit some pretty sweet step backs so far, and has swallowed some guys up the way you like to see young shot blockers do. But I still think he's going to be more of a 15, maybe 20-minute a game guy ultimately, especially because they're kind of bringing him along slowly due to his health issues. He does look much better, by the way, running. I think that stuff that came out in pre-draft about how they're making some adjustments for him, and I think the Pacers staff is still working with him on like his running form and getting him aligned properly and, fixing the weakness in his glutes and various other things has helped, and he looks much better, but, it's going to be a long process for him.
Yeah, if you haven't read that Draft Express piece, that's the one that I'm thinking of. There might've been another one. It's still, even though it's a little bit outdated because he's already been drafted, I think it's worth reading just about the physical component of that, of the game.
Yeah. And his agents, Andy Miller and company, did a nice job of both identifying and correcting those in real life, but then also controlling kind of the media blitz around that, as evidenced by the fact that we're talking about it. The Clippers, how do you think it's going with kind of that fifth starter along with their core four so far, finding that guy? It's been Lance so far.
There are very brief moments where you can see some good things from Lance. His passing has been a little bit more present than before, but offensively it's a huge problem. And you think about what you want in that fifth guy for them is basically somebody that the other team won't cheat off. And right now, he absolutely has not been that guy.
Yeah, he's shooting 28% from three on, obviously a small number of attempts, only 2 out of 7. So that's, I shouldn't even say 28%. I should just say the number. But he has gone back to being much more of a supporting player, when you consider what his usage has been. He's only 14% usage rate, although he turns the ball over quite a bit still. Never gets to the line, shooting most of his shots as threes, and has a 7.8 PR. So hasn't been great so far. Paul Pierce, not capable, I don't think, of playing starters minutes. I would assume that they will go with him most of the time at the three, although Pierce has been getting most of his minutes as a small ball four with the second unit, and Josh Smith has been the five with the second unit. And that second unit played really well against Dallas, against what was Dallas's third unit, I guess. their first unit kind of didn't play in that game and blew things open. So we'll see. I mean, we can expect Doc Rivers to go to very bench-heavy lineups, if not all bench players, a lot during the second and fourth quarters early on. We'll see how that works.
I think Blake has looked really good.
Oh, yeah, this just ended.
Yeah, I think that I think that warrants mentioning, if we're talking about the Clippers, that Blake has, I think he's been phenomenal, and his handling at the four is, it's not unique, but it's quite good.
Yeah, and he's looking pretty explosive. The jumper has been falling, and you know, it's, he almost kind of scores in a way sometimes where you don't realize how many points he has, and you look down and he's got 20 at the half or something like that, which is surprising for a guy who's considered one of the more spectacular guys, but you kind of don't really count mentally like all the jumpers and like floaters that he hits, or at least I don't. That's actually another thing to note too. Other than Harden, all the big superstars in the league are looking really good so far, aren't they?
Anthony Davis.
Kind of about what? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. Okay, I take it back. Yeah, because Harden, LeBron's been, you know, about what you'd expect from him, and then AD has not really kind of fulfilled expectations so far. But we'll get to New Orleans. But speaking of fulfilling expectations, we can talk about the Los Angeles Lakers defense so far.
Oh my god. I kind of don't want to talk about it, because at this point it's just, you're just beating a horse that's been dead for like months.
It's worse than last year somehow. In that first quarter against Sacramento, it's the worst defensive quarter that I can remember, because it wasn't even like, oh, we're giving up, there's a pick and roll and now we're giving up penetration and there's an open three. It wasn't even to that level. It was Mades misses, just going down and scoring a fast break layup pretty much every time for Sacramento. Every once in a while, they'd be forced to run a pick and roll, and then they'd just throw it to the roll guy, and he would score. And they had 80 points in the paint in that game, which was the most that there had been since George Karl's Nuggets team had scored 90, I think about 3 years ago. And, I mean, the Lakers just, it was rough. And Hibbert got in foul trouble. Hibbert was actually only a minus four in that game, so maybe you can look at that as somewhat of a silver lining, that it wasn't all his fault. A lot of it was him not being in the game, and they don't really have any kind of a backup center at all. I also thought the quotes from Byron Scott about everyone saying that they were tired and they just looked tired in the game, which they certainly did. Maybe that's because you ran them into the ground during training camp, Byron.
There are just a lot of warning signs, and I felt bad about ripping on, like, saying that they were going to be a bad team this year, but they are. That's just what's going to happen.
But maybe we can have another Baxter Holmes article where the Lakers try to finally open up about how good their training staff is and how good their analytics are. But, yeah, you know what? A, none of that stuff in the Gary Vee thing really seemed to make a ton of scientific sense to me to start with, about the whole green, yellow and red zone, and like how are you determining what these categories even are? And then of course you have to actually apply these things on the court, which does not appear to necessarily have been done yet.
You ready to move on? I'm sad.
That's what that long pause was for. Yeah.
The team we're going to is a team that we're going to see on Monday, which is when most people listen to this, and that's the Memphis Grizzlies.
Yeah. So we'll have a lot about them tomorrow. But do you have any kind of brief observations about them at all?
I'm thrilled that Brandon Wright already has pick and roll chemistry with both point guards. I think he's nice in that role. We both like the signing. I didn't get to see the game when they got shellacked by the Cavs, but they looked respectable against the Pacers. Is Marc Gasol fine? I remember that there was an issue in that game.
Was there? No, I actually don't remember.
Okay.
But I mean, we haven't seen anything on it.
Yeah, it would have hit our radar by now.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I haven't heard that he's not going to play or something on Monday. But yeah, Wright, and this is something that comes in for our next team, the Heat, too, is just having a guy not only who can catch and finish on the pick and roll, but who can catch alley-oops is such a big deal, because really what makes pick and roll defense, the great pick and roll defenders who are big men, obviously there's the ability to move your feet, but Bogut, for example, isn't incredibly quick. What enables him to be so good is that he's able to deter the guard from getting all the way to the rim while also staying on the axis well enough between the guard and the big that he can't just throw it to the big either, and that allows you to guard the pick and roll with two guys. Once you have a guy who can catch alley-oops, though, now you're basically, you can't guard the pick and roll with two guys because you don't have to worry about that guy being on the axis. You just throw it over his head and the guy dunks on his head. So that means you have to bring that backside wing in on the pick and roll to help, and that's when you really start to cause problems. That's why being able to catch an alley-oop on the pick and roll is so important, as opposed to just a guy who's kind of more groundbound, but, you know, can still kind of catch and finish, you know, a Vucevic type of guy like that when he rolls to the rim, or, you know, a David Lee type. And the Heat with Hassan Whiteside proved that in their game against Houston today.
Yeah, I mean, they did that, and they're also I think that it's impressive to me that they're having a couple of decent games, because it's still, they don't look right to me.
Yeah, they went with Tyler Johnson, played most of the second half. Whiteside was the big star. He had 25 and 16, I think, and had a bunch of blocks as well. I mean, Whiteside, when he's locked in, if he's actually there, you know, he's not quite as aware as some of these other guys are, but if he's in the area, he has the best chance of blocking your shot as anyone in the league, even I would say over Gobert. He just gets guys. Mm-hmm. And Gobert might go verticality a little bit more, but Whiteside, like, that's why he just has these games where he has like 10 blocks every once in a while, or 8 blocks or 6 blocks. It's just, he challenges shots at the rim in a way that no one else in the league does. It's just, he's not quite as aware on a consistent basis, but the hope for the Heat obviously is that he's getting there. And, it was certainly important in allowing the Rockets to only score 26 points on 48 possessions in the second half as the Heat came back from like 21 down.
And as David Thorpe mentioned, the Rockets were outscored. Their second half total was less than Miami scored in either of the third or fourth quarters, which is remarkable. That doesn't happen very often.
How long does this go on before Kevin McHale might be in a little bit of trouble?
I mean, they made the Western Conference Finals last year with the second best record.
Doesn't that make it like almost more likely that they would move on from him, though?
I think that makes it more likely that they'd move on from him after this year. But realistically, like, what would, if they were to move on from him, let's say they did it before the All-Star game, where would they go? Is there
I guess it'd probably be like JB Bickerstaff or someone.
Yeah, it's not like they bring in Tibbs.
Yeah,
that would be amazing, though. Tibbs coaching James Harden would just be amazing.
In the middle of a season, yeah. I don't know. I don't want to speculate. It's only been 3 games. They've played some tough teams. Howard has barely played, as you noted. I think I saw that they're the first team ever to lose all 3 of their first games by 20 points.
Yeah, it's only happened, I think, 3 times in the last 2 years, and the other 2 teams were distinctly not good, even though I think the Nets did it, and the Nets made the playoffs, but that was making the playoffs in the Eastern Conference.
I think, wasn't that their first 2 games? I thought I just saw that.
No team has ever done it in the first 3 games of the season, but I think 2 teams did it last year at other times during the year.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
No team had ever done it.
Yeah. So that's pretty rare. I mean, and granted, this Heat game, you know, they were up by a lot. It's probably a little bit of an aberration.
It was like a 42-point swing, something like
that. Yeah. I mean, the Heat basically did to them what they did to the Clippers in that game in the playoffs, game 6 collapse. Justice Winslow looks good for the Heat, mm-hmm. and it was really interesting to see him matched up with Harden, because Winslow grew up in Houston, and it's clear that he was living in Houston, less than 2 years ago. And it's clear that he has incorporated a ton of Hardenisms into his own game, driving to the basket, although he's probably a little more athletic even than Harden. He's got a quick first step. He actually beat Harden with one of his own moves, a quick Euro step. I mean, they look very similar, at least driving to the basket. Obviously, Harden, you know, much more skilled from a ball skill standpoint. But Winslow has at least been hitting his corner threes and shooting that with no hesitation. So that's going to be really important. And Winslow is unbelievable in the type of helter-skelter game that this was in the second half. He is just... he'll make effort plays, he'll get on the glass, he'll get loose balls. Like, that's really his number one skill, and he's always been good at that, you know, going back to when I first saw him in the 2013 Under-19 World Championships.
Yeah, I love him on this team. It was something we said when they drafted him. I think that it will suit him well, and he will help keep them in games. That lineup, the lineup they used today to basically to kind of take control of the game was Chalmers, Wade, Tyler Johnson, Winslow, and Whiteside, which is just crazy. But at the same time,
so Winslow was playing the four,
and it totally worked. Granted, part of that was because Houston imploded, but it still worked.
Well, and Houston went incredibly small in this game as well. They started Ariza at the four and Harden at the three.
Yeah.
And then McHale, even at the end, was playing Corey Brewer at center against Whiteside as in a last desperate gambit to come back, which obviously didn't work, and they brought the lead out even further. The Bucks are 0-3. What is the panic level for this team right now?
It's low. I mean, because the first game they got waxed by the Knicks, but they didn't have Giannis because he was serving a one-game suspension. I think he's...
Yeah, and he is by far their best player.
Absolutely.
I think,
and he's
that,
looking
that's
good.
That's what this has shown.
And I think that they have a hole right now at power forward, but they don't have Jabari, and we're still in this weird phase. We talked about this a couple days ago where we still don't know exactly what his timetable is, but I was hoping for more from just their team in general than they've gotten, but they're not even close to panicking yet.
Yeah, I mean, their power forward rotation right now is Chris Copeland and Johnny O'Brien. John Henson has been out with Achilles soreness as well as sore left Achilles. O.J. Mayo has had a hamstring injury as well. So they've missed those guys a little bit. Their bench has been kind of getting worked. General Grievous has not looked very good either. I would have liked to see them play Monroe a little bit more with some of those bench guys. That would give them somewhere to go for offense, and some of those bench guys can shoot a little bit better too. Also, Chris Middleton is really struggling to start the year. I'm sure he'll get it back, and especially if they can get Jabari in there and get one more guy to create a little bit and put Middleton into a little bit more of a spot-up role. He's kind of had to drive off closeouts and shoot more mid-range jumpers, which ultimately you don't want him doing. I will say that Johnny O'Brien looks better, mm-hmm. you know, last year when he was pretty much unplayable, but him and Copeland is still not, you know, where you want to be as a starting power forward rotation.
And one other thing I'll mention, I'm not trying to read too much into this, I think Fred Katz mentioned this, is that since the Michael Carter-Williams trade last year, and I think he was just talking regular season, the Bucks are 11-22, which is not to say, oh, Michael Carter-Williams is a disaster or anything like that, but it does show how fundamentally different their team has played since then.
Yeah, that's true. The Wolves have beaten two really bad teams so far. They're 2-0. Karl Towns looks unbelievable, though. That game that he had against Denver was just a tour de force on both ends. I think he had 28-14 in that game. But the even more encouraging thing for me, at least for their near-term prospects, is the fact that he looks like he's an above-average defender at center already in terms of his pick-and-roll defense. He's able to get up pretty high for compared to most centers and still able to retreat back to the ball. He's just got a lot of mobility. I have not seen him make a ton of mistakes as far as missing rotations, missing help assignments, and that's really encouraging for them. I do think ultimately when we see them play some real teams, it's going to be a step back for them, especially offensively with them starting Prince still, in that starting lineup. I don't think that's really going to work out that well. I don't think the Lavinia point guard thing is going to work out, but you know, 2-0, it's been a while for them, and at least they've shown that they can beat some bad teams.
Yeah, and that's important in terms of the overall, not for the arc of this season, but just, you know, that's a step that teams need to go through. That's something the Lakers didn't do last year, a couple other teams didn't do last year. Obviously, the Sixers have their own demons to battle, but Towns has looked amazing. That's really the takeaway of this, and if Ricky Rubio's shooting that he had against the Lakers can be even sporadic, that would be huge, but I want to see it before I anoint it.
Yeah, he came right back to earth and shot
absolutely
in that game against the Nuggets, so you know, let's slow down a little bit on him suddenly being even an average shooter.
Yeah.
The Pelicans look awful. Worst defense in the league through three games that they've played the Warriors twice. And the Blazers, we should note that the three games that they've played have been just about the absolute worst matchups you can have when you have point guards coming in off the scrap heap who have been with the team for like 3 days. Your communication issues for Lillard and then Curry twice. Pretty rough, although Curry even lit up Jrue Holiday, who didn't play in the first game between the clubs, obviously in that 53-point game that he had over the weekend. We have not seen much from the Pelicans so far, and defensively, they should be better than this, even considering the teams that they've played, I think.
They should be. One other thing I want to mention is that they played the Warriors on ring night, and then they played on the tail end of a back-to-back, they played the Blazers, who were at their home opener, and I think that doesn't justify that they lost that game and that they didn't play super well, in my opinion, but they have a lot of injuries. The more depth they add, the better, but you know, it is concerning because something that we've talked about before and that will be a storyline this year is that teams in the West in particular, they're going to need to up their game just to make the playoffs. And that so if they stumble and, you know, let's say they go 3-8 or something like this, that to start the season, that makes it that much harder to get to where they want to get to later in the year.
Yeah, one thing that Ethan noted the other day is that their trainer, there's sort of this weird cannibalization between football and basketball with Benson owning both teams, and there's still kind of, you know, Mickey Loomis, the Saints GM, has like, you know, the ultimate authority in the Pelicans organization. The trainer is now the Saints' former trainer, and I don't find that particularly promising, especially when you consider this team's injury history. The fact that now this is something that Jeff Stotts talks about, who's a great follow at RotoWire ATC.
Absolutely.
On Twitter. He talks, I forget what the exact, it's like, oh, death spiral is the term that it is, where because you as a training staff are now spending so much time taking care of injured guys, then you're not having the time to take care of the preventative maintenance on the other guys, and then you get more injuries. And as far as just having the manpower and the sort of progressive viewpoint that you need with this team, you know, I don't think that they're really investing a ton of resources where they have the guys to manage all these injuries that well. And, you know, football is a much different game than basketball is when it comes to maintenance and managing players and sort of the overall ethos, where you shouldn't be over the course of an 82-game season just trying to get guys back on the field like you do in football.
It's a big issue, and it's concerning. I had been unaware of that until it came up as a point of discussion. And the death spiral concept that Stotts has talked about is definitely scary when you think about that, how many players they already have. And they've had injuries since the season started. We talked about how they had to get guys back, but they lost Kendrick Perkins to, it was a torn pectoral muscle, right?
Strained.
Okay, good. That's less severe. So,
and that's actually probably good for him because he's had a bunch of shoulder issues. I thought that's what it was initially when he hurt himself. Not that he was really, you know, with Ashik back, he probably shouldn't be playing that much over Ajinta and Ashik anyway.
Strong praise.
But back to the training staff thing. You know, AD hit his head in that game on Saturday. He sprained his ankle later on. No one even like looked at him or anything. And you know, basketball, you got to maintain guys over the course of a year. AD is going to be playing a ton of minutes, it looks like, especially as they desperately try to get back into things in this early part of the season with everyone else hurt. And, you know, you can't just, like, shove some Toradol in a guy and throw him back out there.
Yeah, ready to move on to the Knicks?
Yes, after that nice rant.
I wanted to give you enough space if you wanted to go more on it. We're already blowing.
I don't know. I'm probably being overly harsh on the Pelicans training staff. I should say that. It's a little bit too snarky, and maybe after just watching another day of football and just how incredibly ridiculous football is and the injuries and the stuff that guys put them through in that sport, maybe I'm a little bit too anti-football at the moment. So just any association with that has kind of aroused my ire. So maybe I'm being too harsh there. But so Carmelo brought the Knicks to 2-2 with an awesome 37-point performance on the road against the Wizards on Saturday night. I didn't watch this game. I saw the highlights. He's still not really getting to the basket a ton. He at least was shooting more threes. He always seems to light up Otto Porter. He killed him in the preseason, too. So I'm not ready to jump right on board to the Carmelo bandwagon after this one good game with two bad games. I think this is kind of the variability that you get with a guy who takes a lot of contested jump shots, especially when, and if you don't have kind of that free throw line baseline to prop you up on the days that you're not hitting those. But the Knicks are 2-2. It's better than we would have thought they'd be at this point, I guess.
It is, and their other win was a major aberration game, which is that game against the Bucks when Giannis didn't play. But they beat the Wizards, and they beat the Wizards in D.C. So that's, you know, not that the Wizards are great shakes. It's not like they're the Warriors at home or anything like that. But, yeah, I mean,
I'm sorry. They're 2-1. They're not 2-2, right?
I think they're 2-1, but...
Yeah, they are. They've only played three games. That's right.
Very few teams have played four. But anyway, it's still better than we expected, so kudos.
We'll see what happens with these guys. You know, Porzingis has been okay so far. Nothing amazing.
Well, and they've been playing Vucevic, which shouldn't happen anymore.
Vucevic?
Sasha. Vujicic, sorry.
Oh, Vujicic. Yeah, yeah.
Apologies.
Yeah, that's the second... The second Balkan last name you butchered in this podcast. You called him Miritic.
Oh yeah, you're right.
Earlier, that was. I thought we got past that. Like once we learned that it wasn't Vlade Divac back in 1989. But Danny,
I was only 4 years old then. So
I'm just salty after you corrected my Zach LaVine pronunciation.
That's fine, but
which is required.
Yeah. So Oklahoma City played arguably the most entertaining game so far of the year, and inarguably, and they also beat the Spurs. I think they've looked good, but they haven't looked dominant in that sense, other than maybe Westbrook and Durant.
Yeah, I mean, so they're 3-0 now. They blew out the Nuggets today. As long as those two guys look dominant, then this is a dominant team.
Yep, that's fair.
That's always been the operating assumption.
And Waiters has been better than I ever would have expected. He's been more of a team player, and that's notable for them.
Yeah, the crunch time offense didn't look much better under Brooks than it, or Brooksevin, as I called him on Twitter. I mean, it was basically, I think, nobody other than Durant or Westbrook initiated the action or took a shot. I think Adams had like a couple of offensive rebounds over the course of the two overtimes, and that was pretty much it. I will say, and I think I said this back when we first started this podcast, but watching Russell Westbrook offensive rebound is just one of my absolute favorite things in the league.
Absolutely. He's awesome. He's just an amazing, and I hope that we don't see it just because I love these guys together, but I'm really intrigued to see when he's in his prime what he can do if he's just given free reign over everything.
So the Magic, 0-3, three really close games, although they kind of came back against the Bulls today after being down, and that was against the Hoiburgo lineup, so I wouldn't give him as much credit there. But Skiles broke out some kind of weird lineups, but they made a comeback. I mean, I think Skiles will do that on occasion, especially when his team is down. You know, he was the guy who introduced us to Gennaro Pargo trying to shoot the Bulls back into games back in the mid-2000s. But one thing I noted about him, he may have cost the Magic a couple of games. We don't know this for sure, but by not taking Vucevic out in late-game defensive situations after a timeout. John Wall scored the winning bucket against Vucevic in a pick-and-roll in that first game on Wednesday, and then the Thunder repeatedly cooked Vucevic in the same situation for buckets. And then finally, on the last possession of the game, I think when they were up, when they were down by two and they needed a stop, they put in Dedmon. And Dedmon actually stopped Westbrook on the pick and roll, but then the Thunder got the offensive rebound and were able to kill it after that. But, you know, I'm critical of that. On the other hand, you can say, look, he's a new coach. He's still trying to learn the capabilities of his players. He's trying to empower his players to believe that because he is there now, they are going to be better at the things that they weren't good at before. Maybe you can say that about Vucevic, but on the other hand, you know, that's two losses in the stat sheet now. And so there's a fine line between empowering guys and trying to instill them with confidence, especially because, you know, if you're Vucevic, how good are you going to be at pick and roll defense over the course of the game if you know that you're so bad at it that the coach takes you out whenever he really needs a pick and roll stop? So I understand keeping him in, keeping the starters in, but on the other hand, that's two losses now that potentially, we don't know for sure, but potentially could have been avoided with a defensive replacement.
The other thing we have to mention is, to me, Oladipo and Aaron Gordon have looked a lot better than last year, and that's huge for the long term of this team.
Yeah, Hezonja only played like 6 minutes tonight, though. Were you aggrieved?
I mean, I can understand why Skiles would go insane with that guy. I mean, he's a wonderful player. I love him for reasons that are both rational and irrational, but that will happen. And but I think the story with them, though, is Oladipo and Gordon.
The Magic play at the Pelicans and at the Rockets. It's going to be two desperate teams on a back-to-back. I think the Rockets play at the Thunder tomorrow. So the Rockets could be 0-4. The Pelicans could be 0-3 at that point. So those are going to be some real interesting games. I mean, the Magic could be looking at 0-5, and then they'll have a home date against the Raptors, who have been great, and then they'll finally play at the Sixers on Saturday. That'll maybe be their chance to right the ship. But, you know, and they probably, I'd say they play better than the Pelicans so far, so maybe they should be close to considered pretty even in that game. But
if they start that game with Tobias Harris on Anthony Davis, I'm going to go insane.
We'll see. He's not like some unbelievable post-up guy, but yeah, I mean, who else are they going to have guarding?
Aaron Gordon?
Oh, Gordon doesn't start for them.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, we saw a lot of Jason Smith down the end of this game. Shabazz Napier got in. Fry played a little bit in the first half, but barely. Deadman was out of the rotation. I don't know what he did to get out of the rotation. So, and I thought that, you know, the Magic played well against two good teams in their first two games. I'm not sure why there was a need to change up.
Don't you wish they had Kylo Quinn?
Yeah, although Smith has been okay. He was okay in that Bulls game.
Yeah, he helped keep them in it, but I'm just thinking.
He actually hit a three, too, yeah. which was amazing.
In terms of those defensive replacement situations, I think it would be a lot easier, a lot more conscionable to make that sub when your backup is Kylo Quinn, who's, I would say, a strong defender.
Yeah, Deadman is pretty good, too.
Yeah, he is.
I mean, he's just kills the offense. That's why he doesn't play that much. Let's move on to the Sixers. Jahlil Okafor, a lot of Sixers fans have been asking me what I thought of him. And he had 26 points in his first game, also had 8 turnovers. Didn't really change my opinion much of what he's going to be. When they double him, he has not really been able to be too effective, partially because they don't have a ton of shooters around him. And with that being the case, you know, he does not really get into the line, not a ton of power moves. His jump shot looks better than I thought it would be at this point. He's been taking a lot of tough contested jumpers and hitting them, and then I didn't see the game against Utah, but I think that was just a black hole for them. How about the Suns? You got any thoughts on them at all?
The Suns have been I've been encouraged by a couple pieces. Markieff has been doing well. I've been surprised that I think you and I both like Mirza Teletovic. He hasn't played a ton, but they still need to kind of figure out what ails them. They had that rough first game, and then they beat the Blazers twice, but I don't take too much out of that. The Blazers just aren't as good as the Suns.
Yeah, we haven't seen TJ Warren at the four a ton yet, so that's something I thought we'd see. Markieff actually shooting threes, 4 of 9 on the season, so that's good to see. If he can start hitting that regularly, that'll be good. And we thought, oh man, they got blown out by Dallas in that first game, but then they beaten Portland twice since then pretty comfortably. So, yeah, maybe the Suns can still, and the defenses look good in those last two games against the Blazers, a lot closer to what I thought. So, you know, obviously one bad game against Dallas, maybe don't overreact, or two good games against the Trailblazers, don't overreact.
And that leads into the Blazers, which, I mean, they're a team that is really just kind of ridiculous right now. McCollum had that crazy first game against the Pelicans, which was the day after Curry lit them up too. But I still have trouble seeing how this team beats teams regularly.
Yeah, I think they just explode offensively at home, and the Suns have a pretty decent defensive backcourt, 2 point guards to match up with their kind of 2 point guard size guys. Lillard, 32% usage. McCollum, 26% usage. Nobody else above 20 on the team. Those are really the only two creators that they have. The Kings, two small observations on them since we got to kind of speed things up a little bit here. They are playing smaller under Carl, despite the fact that they have had Cauley-Stein and Kufos alternating in the starting lineup, and those are kind of their big acquisitions. We've seen a lot of Rudy Gay at the four, and I think that's his best position these days because he looks a little bit heavier. He's shooting better, though. I think he is really more moving into where his best position is as a full-time four because he doesn't quite have the quickness to get by threes anymore. off the dribble, and then Rondo has looked good so far.
Yeah, he has, and we'll see what their best five is moving forward. I think they're going to be a team that I want to watch a lot more, especially assuming Cousins is relatively healthy, and that's I'm intrigued. I hope he plays, but I will be intrigued to see how they handle it if he has to miss any games.
Yeah, Rondo also doing a really nice job of finishing at the rim. He's looking for that more. Has had some really clever finishes. Granted, many of them were against the Lakers, but he also had 20 points against the Clippers the other night as well on the road. For the Spurs, I like what LaMarcus has been doing on D. He got into it a little bit more offensively after kind of not shooting that well in the first two games. Tony Parker not really doing that much yet, though.
He isn't. I've thought a little bit about that. You and I worried about it before the season. Kawhi has been awesome, in my opinion. I think he's been great so far. His defense has been good, and he hit a dagger three today. And I'm still not really sure where the Spurs fit in terms of the elite teams, but I'm still sure they're up. They're in that group.
Yeah, the people who are saying Kawhi could be a dark horse MVP candidate, that is incorrect. He's not going to play enough minutes. He's not going to score enough. Let's move on.
Yeah. So Toronto. Toronto has, I think they've looked pretty good overall. What do you think is the best explanation for that?
Oh, the defense is way better. That perimeter defense, it's really fitting into exactly what Masai Ujiri had hoped that they would be so far. And they're getting just enough shooting. Terrence Ross has had some moments. Bismack Biyombo has looked great defending on that second unit. I mean, that second unit has gone from being absolutely horrible defensively with guys like Vazquez and Lou Williams to having guys like Corey Joseph and Carroll play some with the second unit. Biyombo, and Carroll has looked great too. His jump shot looks even better than it did last year with Atlanta.
Yeah, I think that they're looking good. I want to see more from them. And another team, but this one is unsurprising that their defenses look good. Utah has, just defensively, they've looked monstrous, but some of that has been context dependent.
Yeah, they played the Sixers, but I mean they held that second half against the Pacers. Really, that last three quarters against the Pacers on Saturday was ridiculous. They held the Sixers like 71 points, 75. They are playing at the slowest pace in the league again by far, only 93 possessions per NBA.com. But I think so far, and they held down the Pistons pretty well too. Not great offensive teams, but they've made a big contribution to making them be bad offensive teams so far when, you know, they're a third of the sample size for all those teams. So yeah, I think there's a lot of good reason to believe that their defense is going to be nearly as good as last year. And the Jazz actually have the second best net rating in the league so far behind the Warriors.
That's impressive. I didn't know that.
Last one, Washington Wizards playing way faster. All of their games have been incredibly high scoring and entertaining, and fundamentally on a pace adjusted level, they're basically the same team as last year.
You know how much I love running off makes. It's one of my favorite things, and with John Wall, it's been a godsend. But you're right that there isn't a lot that's fundamentally different, but that does change. It changes not only the Wizards, but it changes the fatigue level of the teams as they defend them.
Yeah, you want to guess who is the highest, what team plays at the highest pace in the league so far?
My instinct is the Warriors, but I'm not sure.
They are fifth. The Los Angeles Lakers are first.
Oh, because their defensive possessions are like 2 seconds because a guy gets by them and scores.
That is correct. And also they jack up long twos early in the clock.
And they're jacking up a lot of threes because the media members made fun of Byron Scott.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess that's, you know, Scott evolves. He just evolves at a relatively glacial pace. All right, anything else we got to do before we wrap up?
No, I think that's about it. This is the only thing I'll mention is I write the League Pass Alert column for Sporting News, and that'll come out tomorrow. So if you want to keep tabs on it during the week, it'll have a slide for each day.
Awesome. If you would like to support the podcast, please do so. There are many ways, such as through an iTunes rating or ranking. That's really good. You can follow my Facebook page, Nate Duncan NBA. Danny's Facebook page, keep up with his writing, is Danny LaRue NBA. The sponsors, DraftKings, of course, our kind sponsor for this podcast. You can use the Capspace code on there or at SeatGeek. And we're hoping to announce a really cool new sponsor soon as well. But you'll have to wait, because that's the only reason that you listen to this, of course, is for the sponsors. You'll have to wait to find out who that is until future episodes. So for Danny, this has been the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. We'll talk to you all next time.